Dear friends in Christ, a friend of my husband once remarked that God has set no limits, has set limits to human intelligence, but none to his stupidity. Which is another way of saying that, unfortunately, we human persons, unless we learn humility and are held by grace, are going to fall prey to any sort of nonsense that happens to be fashionable. And a case in point is what I'm going to call the tragedy of contemporary feminism, or the rhetoric which is being discussed and spread has a lot of influence on thousands of women. And actually what we have to, I'm going to try to do, is to show to you that in spite of the pseudo-convincing characters of these accidents, of these arguments, in fact what is happening is a total caricature of the true nature of women and their tremendous mission in the church. I'm so deeply convinced that the mission of women is so great and so enormous that the spiritual welfare of the church depends upon the attitude that women takes towards their mission and towards femininity. Now, in order to refute feminism, is this functioning properly? In order to refute feminism, it is extremely important to understand that they give a wrong response to certain facts that cannot be denied. I don't think that it can be denied that some women have been very badly treated indeed. And this was true of the past, and it is still true of the present. But this does not only apply to women. It applies to minorities. It applies to people that are handicapped. It applies to people that happen to be different. In other words, because of original sin, we're going to find out that some people are always opposing other people and making them suffer for reasons which are totally legitimate. Now, obviously, we all know that there's an abysmal difference between Christian countries and pagan countries. But there's no doubt that in pagan countries, for centuries and centuries and centuries, and still today, some women, or maybe all women, have been treated as inferior, has been treated as stupid or untalented, or being second-hand citizens. And to a certain extent, it is also true of our society. And this is the official excuse for the feminist revolt. Now, in every situation in human life, there are two possibilities. All of us find ourselves in difficult or tragic or complicated situations, which God allows. And in every situation, there's a possibility of giving the right response, and there's a possibility of giving the wrong response. Now, in order to give the right response, we're going to need prayer and God's grace. In order to give the wrong response, we don't need any help at all. We can very well do it on our own. And this is precisely what happens in the case of feminism. In other words, suppose that a woman has been badly treated, has been rejected as being inferior, has been humiliated. The feminist response is going to be bitterness and resentment. The Catholic response or the Christian response is going to be very different, as I will try to show you. Chesterton once wrote, what is the difference between myself and feminists? That whereas I want to correct abuses against women, what feminists are trying to do is to destroy femininity. And this is a brilliant way of putting it. Actually, what the feminists try to do is to abolish femininity. Now, is it true that men have said pretty awful, have written pretty awful things about women? I say, yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, for a while, I made a collection of all the abysmal stupidities that some men have said about women. And what is very sad is sometimes the stupid things that have been said about women have been said about men that are very talented, because talent does not prevent you from producing stupidities. Keep this in mind, it's extremely important. We sort of assume that when someone is intelligent, whatever is going to produce is going to be true. It's not true at all. As a matter of fact, you need a certain type of intelligence to invent certain type of stupidities. You know, a very dull person is not likely to produce it. I mean, for example, you take a very famous Aristotle called Aristotle. Well, Aristotle speaks of women as being misshapen men. And the great Thomas Aquinas, who was a great saint and a great man, you know, at times he's just a disciple of Aristotle, and he repeats the very same thing, even though he acknowledges that women are necessary for procreation. Because suppose that we had a universe made up exclusively of men, we all know that it's not going to last very long. It's going to come to an end very rapidly. Now, of course, if you turn to literature, sometimes you find, particularly among German thinkers, some abominable formulation about women. Schopenhauer, who hated women because for some reason he claimed that his sister had taken too much of the inheritance or something of the sort, wrote terrible things about women. Nietzsche, with what I'm going to call Teutonic graciousness, writes in one of his books, when you go to a woman, do not forget your whip. Which is a very gracious way of talking about the way that women should be treated. Freud, who had, as you know, an enormous influence in the 20th century, and in some way particularly in the United States, claims that every girl is born with what he calls penis envy. The very moment that a little girl is born, she realizes that there's something sadly lacking in her anatomy. This may be the reason why so many babies have hepatitis, which is a sickness of the liver, which is affected by the fact that you worry. Now, that is a theory that the brilliant Freud has produced. But I happen to have a little niece. When she was 6 years old, she had a little sister aged 5 and then another little sister aged 2, and she had never seen a little boy. And one day, my sister had to take her to the doctor, and there was another woman with a little boy, and at one particular moment, the nurse came in and said, you know, the doctor is coming any moment, undress the children. So my little niece, for the first time in her life, at the age of 6, saw what a little boy looked like. And she turned to my sister with horror and said, you know, that one is very, very sick, mommy. To which my sister said, no, Mary, no. He's a little boy and they happen to be made different. He says, oh, no, I can tell you immediately, that looks awfully bad. And the little boy was called in first. And after a few moments, there was terrible screaming. My little niece said to my sister, I told you, mommy, it was serious. The doctor is removing the tumor. So you see, whereas Freud says a little girl suffers because she's something too little, my little niece says, you know, it's a very bad case because he's something too much. And a few weeks later, she was at the Belgian seashore, and she came to my sister very pensively, and she says, "Mommy, I fear this sickness is rather widespread." Now, just to show you, the whole question is, how do you look at things? Well, obviously, it's possible to look at women as being misshapen men. And it's also possible to look at men as being misshapen women. You see, therefore, the whole question is perfectly nonsensical. Now, what I would like to throw to you is that women have a very special role in the church. You know, because obviously, if you look at women from a purely secularistic point of view, as people do in our society, because we live in a society which is totally secularized, we've got to realize this. You know, that religion is being rejected, systematically eliminated from politics, from education, from daily life. That obviously, if you look at it with purely secularistic eyes, women seem to be in an inferior position. Why? Because when you read any history textbook, or any book on art, or philosophy, or theology, or literature, 95% of these books speak about men. Who are the great thinkers, the great philosophers, the great theologians, the great painters, the great musicians, the great artists, the great architects, the great politicians, the great generals? Men, 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 men. Is it surprising that men, or many men, develop what I'm going to call a macho complex? And simply say, well, obviously, we men are superior. And of course, when it comes to exterior accomplishments, when it comes to creativity, when it comes to productivity, when it comes to invention, can't we say that men have accomplished a lot more than women have? And the answer is yes. Why deny it? Women have no Beethoven. They have no Shakespeare, they have no Michelangelo, they have no Plato, they have no Aristotle, and therefore can't we draw the legitimate conclusion that women are basically inferior to men? Now, of course, the feminists are going to say to you, it's all due to the fact that women have been crushed by men. Men have, so to speak, prevented them from blossoming. You know, suppose that you have a little plant and you don't give it any water, it's going to die. Therefore, the feminists are going to say, let us create a society in which women are given a chance. And then you will find out, of course, it's going to take a little while, but that in no time women are going to be capable of producing works of art, or theology, or philosophy, or whatever it might be, equal to men. And therefore, men are the guilty people. Men are those that have prevented women from becoming what they're called upon to be. Therefore, let us start a revolution. Let us join a club started by a woman called Valérie Solanas, to form a club that she called, I forgot how she called it, it's just as well. But the basic of it is, let us crush up men. In other words, let us wage war on men. And as a matter of fact, they even have developed the crazy idea that if you had a bank sperm, particularly regionally, all men could be killed and eliminated altogether. Nevertheless, the human race could proceed. You know, very, very cheerful outlook. At any rate, we've got to realize when you look at the situation, not from a secularistic point of view, but from a religious point of view, that the situation is totally different, then all of a sudden looks very much as if women were given some sort of privileged situation. And of course, once again, it is all a question of how you interpret facts, very much as my little niece interpreted the fact that a boy who had a particular organs that she didn't have as a sign that he had a tumor. So I say you can read the Bible in a positive way and you can read the Bible in a very destructive way. If you read Genesis and you find out that Eve was created after Adam, according to the feminist, this is a sign that, so to speak, she was a second thought. You know, actually what God wanted to produce was a male human being, and then afterwards finding out that it was a little bit lonesome, then he produced Eve. But she was, so to speak, an afterthought, and therefore Simone de Beauvoir wrote a famous book, The Second Sex. And then you read The Tragedy of Original Sin. It is Eve who induced Adam to eat of the forbidden fruit, and Adam yielded. By the way, you will notice that it did not put him a particularly strong or a courageous resistance. He didn't say to Eve, you know, don't forget that this has been prohibited, but she gave it to him and he took it. So we might call him the first big wimp. He immediately gave in, no resistance whatever. But what is very striking, if you read the Bible, is that both of them were punished. They lost divine grace, the doors of heaven were shut for both of them, but nevertheless they have individual punishments that are very different. Adam was supposed to earn his bread with the sweat of his brow, but in most countries you're going to find out that Eve pitches in. And if you go to countries like southern Italy, you see the husband riding on a donkey and the wife carrying a heavy burden walking after him. So she's doing both things. I mean, in other words, she's taking his punishment as well. You know, read the books of Pearl Buck on the situation of women in China. You're going to see they were doing most of the work. And men were smoking their pipe or going to brothels. Well, therefore, once again, this crying injustice. And then on top of it is said, you shall be subject to your husband. And therefore, isn't it so that the Bible is definitely placing women in a position of inferiority? And then you're going to give birth in pain and anguish. For men, procreation is a moment of ecstasy. This is why they have nothing against it. But for women, it can be linked to weeks and months of discomfort, ending in the excruciating pains of giving birth. This is what you can call inequality. Isn't that a metaphysical injustice that the feminists are going to take in their hands and reform totally, but ensuring that women have perfect control over their body and can determine exactly whether or not they're going to get pregnant, whether or not they're going to have an abortion, and so forth and so on. This is how they're going to read the Bible. Let us look at the same facts from a purely religious and supernatural point of view. Granted that Eve was created after Adam, does it mean that she was inferior? I read the Bible very differently, because it is said in Genesis that God formed Adam's body from the dust of the earth, a very modest origin, whereas Eve was formed from Adam's body. Now, had God said to me, would you prefer to have your body formed from the dust of the earth or from the body of a human person made to God's image and likeness, I would have chosen the second alternative. This is what is given to women, so you cannot truly say that according to the Bible she's inferior. Well, she's declared to be an afterthought. In other words, God created Adam, and then afterwards he said, well, he's so lonesome, I mean, let him give him another, a companion. If you look at the Bible, Genesis, you're going to see that there's an ascending line in creation from inanimate to plants to lower animals, higher animals, man and then woman. So therefore that she comes last doesn't to me means that she's inferior. Yes, the feminists are going to say, but she's declared to be subject to her husband. How humiliating. She's just as good as he is, and probably even a lot better. And she has to be subject to him. She has to obey him. This is ridiculous. We are not going to accept this sort of nonsense. I'm just as good as my husband, and probably better. So why should I obey him? You know, in many ways, I'm wiser, and I know better than he does, and men have made so many mistakes. The history of the world is a mess. Give women a chance. And then you're going to see that all of a sudden, all our problems are going to be solved. Once again, when turning to the New Testament, and you read that when Christ was found in the temple in Jerusalem, he went back to Nazareth and he was subject to his parents. Now just imagine this extraordinary situation that Saint Joseph had original sin. The Holy Virgin had no original sin, but she was a pure creature. And Christ was God. And he was subject to them. He was subject to both Joseph and Mary. And we women should resent the fact that we should be subject to our husband, even though to be subject to simply means to imitate the humility of Christ, who was God. Now, let us go further. You have the Annunciation. Oh, it is said in Genesis. A woman, you know, there'll be enmity between the serpent and the woman. And the woman shall crush the husband's, the serpent's head. Now, someone came to me after a talk that I'd given a while ago and said to me, you know, you misquoted the Bible. It is not that there's an enmity between the woman and the serpent, and she shall crush the serpent's head. It is said in the Bible, he shall crush the serpent's head. I looked in my Bible, which was pre-Vatican II, and it is definitely said she. But it is quite true that in modern Bible, published afterwards, all of a sudden it is he. You know, I'm a traditionalist, and I still see she will crush the serpent's head, which is, of course, the Holy Virgin replacing Eve, the new Eve, who is just going to crush a serpent's head. Now you turn to the Annunciation. An angel of God appears to a young virgin and offers her to become the mother of God. Where is Saint Joseph to whom she is engaged? Where? No one knows. And one thing is certain, he's not even informed of the fact that his fiancée is with child. And it's only when he notices it that an angel of God informs him of the miracle that has taken place. He's very much in the background. You sort of feel sorry for him. He's not even informed of this fantastic event. Then you have, of course, a question of the crucifixion. Who followed Christ to Calvary? He had 12 apostles. One of them betrayed him for a paltry sum of money. Another one betrayed him and declare solemnly for 3 times, I do not know that man. and the other 10 fled. Courageous men fled. Who followed Christ to Calvary? The holy women and the holy virgin. St. John came back later, but Mary was standing at the foot of the cross. And what is the women's reward? Christ appeared to them first after his resurrection, not to his apostles, to Mary Magdalene, the sinner. And she was the one who was going to inform them that he was risen. And when she came over to the apostles and said, "The Lord is alive, I've seen him," they said, "Woman's talk. Don't take it seriously. I mean, you can't take seriously what women are saying." But she was right. So once again, women are placed in a privileged position from a religious point of view. Then you take the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, and once again you have this duel between the dragon and a woman. And then feminists dare tell us that according to Christian teaching, women are totally and completely in the background, and therefore invite women to revolt against the patriarchalism of our society. The Pope is a man, and cardinals are men, and bishops are men, and women are not even permitted to become priests. This is a scandal that calls for revolution. Now you see, let me go back to my basic principle. God has set limits to human intelligence, but none to his stupidity. And so what is going to happen today is that the false arguments invented by feminists have an enormous influence in our society, including priests and bishops who are intimidated by feminists because they manage to give them a guilt complex. We women have been so badly treated for centuries and centuries. So you have to give in on this and this and this and this and this issue. Yes, say the bishops. Yes, indeed, they have a very good point. Our society, you know, Catholic Church is very undemocratic. You know, after all, everyone should have a word to say. But they can only yield to these arguments because they have lost the sense of the supernatural. And it is one of my basic ideas that women are so much in the forefront of redemption that the mission of women is essentially a religious mission. Women are not called upon to be great theologians or philosophers or artists or inventors or generals or politicians, even though they could be. I mean, after all, now this is a personal opinion that you may accept or reject, but after all, who was the greatest general of all times? The most amazing genius, Joan of Arc, an untutored young girl of 18 with a sort of genius, led French armies to reconquer France. Absolutely amazing. When you read her life, you can't believe your eyes. But, she was fighting in the name of God. And before starting one of her great battles, she would have all her soldiers assembled and say, "No, you all do to confession and to mass, and then we start the battle." And of course, they grumbled. But men cannot resist a woman who is carried by the spirit of true love. And they already did so and won the most amazing victories. Now, I don't recall that Napoleon, when he conquered Europe, said to his soldiers, "Now you first go to confession and to mass, and then we wage battle." But he was defeated. Napoleon was finally defeated and ended in exile. So therefore, it's not a question of whether or not women could be. It is a question that if they turn to be great politicians or great thinkers or whatever it might be, they're selling their privilege for a mess of pottage. That's what they're doing. They're abandoning the magnificent mission which is given to them for something which is quite good, but inferior. Because I claim the greatest mission that a human being can have is a religious mission. And a religious mission implies faith, hope, and charity. It implies that you don't attribute your success to yourself, but that you know that they depend exclusively on God. You know, this is from the fact that women are apparently placed in an inferior position. I say apparently inferior because from a secularistic point of view, from a naturalistic point of view, they are in the background. And suppose that they accept this because God is calling them to a religious mission. A religious mission which is exemplified in some mysterious way by the fact that they collaborate with God in a very special way in the creation of a new human being. Now, I happen to love art and great architecture and great music and great books. But when I read the second epistle of St. Paul, and I'm reminded that the world will be destroyed by fire, that everything is going to be destroyed. You know, the most magnificent things that men have created. Go to Florence, go to Rome, and you're going to see masterpieces of man's creativity, which are overwhelming. And then you meditate and you say to yourself, one day, all this will be dust and ashes, because this is something that we know through Revelation, the world will be destroyed. And of course, the moment that we got the nuclear bombs, you know very well that this could happen. You know, in some way, when the atomic bomb was invented or discovered, I recall saying to myself, God created the world by a fiat. He said, be. And the next moment, something came into existence. Human beings cannot create, but we can destroy. And we are taken by hatred and resentment and metaphysical revolt. We can say, be not. And now today we can press on a button and basically destroy the world. That is a human caricature, the devilish caricature of creation. We are capable of doing it. Not everything is going to be destroyed, but every human being to whom a woman has given life in pain and anguish will live forever because he has an immortal soul. So therefore God is saying to us, all the works of men, great and magnificent as they are destined to total destruction. But whatever human being has been born of a woman will live forever. You know, this truly opens our door, or opens our understanding to the amazing greatness of femininity and the amazing mission of women in the church. When I was a child, the French Academy offered a prize to the person who was going to answer best the following question: why are there more men than women in jail? Which, by the way, is true, we all know. There are many, many more men in jail than women. And the person who received the prize was the one who had written, because there are many more women in churches than men. And it is true. It is less true today because, thanks to feminism, that's one of the great accomplishments of feminism, to have discouraged women from praying, to discourage women from turning to God for help. It's probably easier for women to be religious than men because they're weaker. And this is, to my mind, a tremendous grace. A woman who is giving birth, a woman who is pregnant and suffering, will pray very much as we know there are no atheists in foxholes. You know, when O'Grady was liberated from this extraordinary 6 days that he spent in Bosnia, he prayed. Men pray in ultimate emergencies. When they're in foxholes, all of a sudden they'll get on their knees and say, God, come to my help. But in everyday life, you know, if you were strong and healthy and efficient and productive, why should you pray, for goodness sake? You do mean make it beautifully on your own. A woman is weak, and she knows she is weak. And this is, to my mind, a grace, because it forces you on your knees. God, come to my help. I cannot do it alone. And the feminists are going to say, no, we are just as good as men. We are just as creative. We are just as talented. We can do it on our own. You know, I read something that delighted me that was in California, and a young girl was driving her car and she had a flat tire. Now, if I have a flat tire, believe me, I wouldn't know what to do about it. But she was a very clever little thing, and she immediately took a large piece of paper and wrote on it, I'm not a feminist. And the next moment, a young man stopped and changed her tire. Well, that's what I always do, you know, every time I travel and I have to carry my heavy suitcase and I turn to a man, I say, you know, I'm not a feminist. They always carry it for me. You know, it works, try it, it is worth it. Now, let me go back to my central theme. The mission of women is essentially a religious mission. And if women fulfill it, you know what is going to happen? Deep down, men will look up to her as being superior to them, morally speaking. If they don't fulfill it, men will look down on them as being disgusting. You know, Kierkegaard, the famous Danish philosopher, once wrote, women are either better than men or worse. And if they are better, men are going to look them with them with infinite respect. Men know, and know intuitively, what a woman is like. And I knew a young man who was a real Don Giovanni. He was very handsome and had a fantastic success with women. And I'm sorry to say, he conquered very many of them without much effort. They just fell into his arms. And one day he said to his father, you know, Dad, I have such power over women that I cannot conceive that I would ever be turned down in my advances. It's never happened to me. To which one should add that he was clever enough never to turn to someone who would turn him down. Because he knew intuitively they have no chance. And therefore, he always won, but he was very selective in his approaches. You know, there are some girls who sort of, you know, well, open door, have no objection. And then obviously, you know, an immoral man is going to abuse. But if a woman is truly conscious of the mission that she has and humbly accepts it, doesn't feel superior, but simply accepts the greatness of her mission, which is a religious mission. Now you're going to say to me, well, what do I mean by a religious mission? This is something that needs to be explained in the world in which we live, because we live in a world which is not only a-religious, but is systematically anti-religious. Wherever you go, you can just assume that there's going to be some sort of poison injected into you through newspapers and magazines and televisions and whatever it is, and schools and universities. Always a subtle attack on the religious, because the ideal of modern man is to dethrone God and to replace him. You know, that is a modern age, put in a nutshell. Man should be proclaimed God. God is non-existent. God is an invention of the human mind. You know, this is what the German thinker Feuerbach declared. He's an invention of man's mind. We produce God. And because we have produced this imaginary creature that keeps us under subjection, we have lived in fear, and we have not developed our own potentialities. But if we discover that basically we are God, then all of a sudden the world is going to blossom and to become the magnificent place that it is supposed to be. Now we are reaping the fruits today. And can we truly see that the world is getting better and better, more and more noble, more and more kind and generous? What has taken place in the 20th century is a series of abominations, a series of the most cruel treatments of human beings that you can possibly imagine. That is the result. The moment that you eliminate God, as the French philosopher Gabriel Marcel said, man is agonizing. The moment you forget God, you bury man. And this is what is happening. So therefore, I say more than ever today, we've got to realize women have a mission. And unless young girls are retaught the beauty and greatness and depth of their mission and let themselves be influenced by feminist rhetoric, that unless they become career women, they become like men, they take ascendancy over their husband, they become bosses, they give up their mission, they give up maternity. They decide whether or not they're going to become pregnant, under what conditions, and so forth and so on. In this very moment, the world is doomed. The French thinker Vinet, whose name you might not know, said, if you want to gauge the moral value of a society, examine what its women are like. They determine whether society is morally healthy or not. Even if men go astray, even if they sow their wild oats, it is regrettable, it is deplorable. But the world is not thereby totally ruined. But if women do so, the world is lost. They determine whether society is morally healthy or not. Even if men go astray, even if they sow their wild oats, it is regrettable, it is deplorable, but the world is not thereby totally ruined. But if women do so, the world is lost, precisely because of the crucial importance of their role in the church, in the family, and in society. Now, what do I mean by a religious vocation? You know, there I would like you to pay particular attention, because what I'm going to say is so opposed to what you're going to hear in everyday society that we truly have to sharpen your hearing and your intelligence to understand that what I'm saying is going against the tide. Now, how are people gauged in our society? How do we consider them? We say we praise them as being outstanding or remarkable and so on and so on. According to what they do, to what they accomplish, to what they produce, to what they invent, to how much money they make, whether they are a great athlete or not, whether they win an open tournament, and then you're a great person. Therefore, we are measured totally according to our productivity, to what we realize outside of ourselves. This is not the religious category. Suppose that I were a tennis champion who has won more tournaments than anybody else in the history of tennis, and I were to drop dead and appear in front of my creator, and will come with all my cups and say, look what I have done. Is it going to do me any good? Is just God going to ask you how many times you won a tournament? Is he going to ask you whether or not you've gone to the moon? Is he going to ask you whether or not you have invented a new computer? Is he going to ask you whether or not you've made a fantastic medical invention preventing women from conceiving babies? That was my invention. Imagine I discovered this particular pill which is preventing women from and then God is going to say to me, go into heaven because you have invented a new pill. This one question that he's going to raise. Now, if you love God, your creator, and your neighbor, this is what he's going to ask. Therefore, God is not going to ask you according to your productivity, to your creativity, to inventiveness. God is going to ask you one question. Who are you? And what I am is not determined by what I produce. It is determined by my inner attitude towards God and towards my fellow men made to God's image and resemblance. This is what counts. And keep in mind that death is something which is going to come for all of us, and sometimes much sooner than we realize. And this is what I should be concerned with, and not whether or not my name is going to go down in history, or whether my name is mentioned in the New York Times, you know, which is, of course, for people the peak of greatness, or even if you appear on television a couple of times, you know. People see you in everyday life. They don't pay much attention to you, but if they see you on television once, they say, well, she's on television, therefore she is. You don't exist as long as you're not on television. You know, I mean, it's so ridiculous, but I mean, so it is. I see you and pay no attention to you. I saw you on television yesterday. Well, you must be a great person. Now, therefore, first religious category, the absolute priority of being over productivity. This is what counts. Who are you? You know, you look at the Holy Virgin and you read the New Testament from beginning to end. She's hardly ever mentioned. And she speaks, I believe, only 7 words, all in all. And she's the Queen of Heaven. She's the bride of the Holy Spirit. She's the Mother of God. She's the Queen of Angels because of what she was. And what is going to teach us what she was? The word she pronounced at the Annunciation, I am the handmaid of the Lord. That's all she claims. That is a title of honor. I'm a handmaid. She says that I'm just as good as God. I'm the Mother of God. She's a handmaid. And because of this, she's now crowned in heaven. She is the holiest of all pure creatures, a woman. Now, second religious category, totally opposed to the society in which we live. It is what I'm going to call holy receptivity. And of course, it's closely linked to what I said a moment ago. Because receptivity, to many of us, is going to oppose to activity. Do you realize that we live in a world of mad people? You know, Plato already wrote 25 centuries ago, the world is mad. It hasn't gotten much better in the meantime. It is raving mad. all of us running like mad in all directions. I mean, you just need to drive for a moment on a California highway, all these people rushing full speed, and you don't know what for. They might be rushing towards death, for all I know. Doing, rushing, performing, accomplishing. Now, Aristotle made the great mistake, and don't forget, he was a genius, of saying male are superior to females because male are active and the female is passive. Great Aristotle. I apologize to him officially because I'm not a genius, but I don't want to fall victim to your genius. I'm going to say women are in no way passive at all, they are receptive. And my husband made a crucial distinction between passivity and receptivity. To be passive, it's simply from Latin patire, to suffer. Something is done to you, and that's all there is to it. Whereas receptivity is the most magnificent trait that you can imagine, to open yourself to fecundation. To open yourself to fecundation. And this is expressed magnificently in the sexual sphere. Well, what the woman does is to allow her husband to penetrate into her intimacy and to fecundate her. Now, you will notice that the role of the husband is very essential and simultaneously very, very small. All he does is to give her a living seed that then travels in the female body, fecundates an egg, and in this moment, God creates a new human soul. You know, therefore, you understand that the female body has a note of sacredness that the male body does not possess, because there is a sort of close contact between God and the female body. And this sheds enormous light on what I'm going to call female modesty, which is down the drain today. Even among girls that are daily communicants, they do no longer understand that their body has a mystery that calls for veiling. You know, the woman should be veiled because she carries a mystery in herself. And if she runs 3/4 or 4/5 naked, you know, even though she's a good girl, there's something that she has lost. She has lost an understanding for the mystery of her femininity. You know, this is why I used to love women being veiled in church, because it doesn't mean that they're inferior. It means the veil indicates sacredness. And whatever is sacred is veiled. It calls for respect. It calls for special reverence. A man should not treat a woman the way that he treats another man. A man can do certain things to another man, like hit him on the shoulder, whatever it might be. And if he does the same thing to a woman, it's shocking, because he does not understand there is something sacred and mysterious about women that should be respected and should be expressed in their way of dressing, in their way of talking, in their way of sitting, in their way of moving. And when a man sees that, he will respect a woman. And if he no longer sees it, he's going to say, well, you know, she's just like anybody else, and treat her disrespectfully. You can truly see that what's so typical of women is that they're geared towards contemplation. Now, Aristotle, who had declared a moment ago that males were superior to females because males are active and the woman is purely passive, that he confuses with receptivity. The very same Aristotle places contemplation above action. And he's perfectly right. Contemplation of God, this is going to be heaven. Don't you expect that in heaven you're going to be busy the whole day long? Busy bodies running all around. No. We'll be contemplating the infinite holiness and perfection of God. And this perfection is so infinite that eternity cannot exhaust it. This is going to be heaven.
to know God and to contemplate his perfection. Now, a woman is called upon to contemplation, which is linked to receptivity in a special way. You know, there is something so beautiful and so profound and so moving when a woman breastfeeds her child, and she looks at the baby and the baby looks at her, and there's a loving interchange without words. That is contemplation. And on top of it, you know, contemplation on a purely natural level, but then when it comes to the contemplation of God, it means an emptying of oneself, an immense silence, so that we can hear God talk. This is contemplation. In contemplation, you don't say, and you keep cutting it up. No. You empty yourself of yourself so that God can talk to you. When you contemplate breastfeeding, you know, as opposed to the abominable bottle feeding, you know, which is finally can be done by a machine, you know, very much as you can milk cows, you put some sort of an instrument, then it's done mechanically. What is so beautiful about breastfeeding is that the child partakes of the very body of the woman, of the mother. She's giving him her very flesh in giving her milk. And of course, this is on a purely natural level a beautiful symbol of what happens when Christ comes into us and nourishes our soul with eternal food. Once again, the amazing privilege of women. This is why the female breast, once again, has something sacred. And this is why every woman worthy of this name should feel that her breast should be veiled. And today you can say that clothing and fashion do their very best to eliminate this or to make it as visible as can be. Once again, we've lost this amazing sense for the mystery of femininity. You know, a woman knows intuitively, and this is once again very a religious category, that personal is infinitely superior to what is impersonal. God is a person. God is not a thought. God is not an abstraction. God is not an ideal. God is, as St. Augustine puts it, a living and loving God. He's a person. And we are persons in a very imperfect way. God alone is a perfect person, and we are called upon to be transformed into God so that we become perfect by sharing in his life. We are very imperfect persons. Now, a woman, up to the feminists, knew, of course, that whatever is personal is infinitely superior to what is impersonal. It is not difficult for men to understand this. And I can only tell you, if you entered a room, and in one part of the room there's a newborn baby in a cradle, and on the other side there is a brand new computer, and you let women come into the room, where are they going to go? Look at the baby, because they're normal. Whereas, what are men going to do? They're going to have a look, and the next moment start playing on the computer. You must be raving mad. I mean, a computer is only a computer. A baby is a marvel of God's creation. No human creation can even resemble by a fraction the mystery of another human being. When you realize that the husband gives his wife a living seed, that's all that he gives, so small that you can't see it with a microscope, or possibly a very powerful microscope. And after 9 months, what does she give back? A being made God to God's image and likeness. You know, it's so amazing. There's such a discrepancy between what she receives and what she gives back. Well, that is what I called the mystery of receptivity. You know, that you let yourself be fecunded, that you find the same thing in the life of grace. That I, imperfect human being, if I fully open myself to God's grace, which I constantly refuse and turn down, I'll be transformed into Christ. And what a discrepancy between my miserable creaturehood, my imperfections, my sins, my limitations, my wickedness. And if I truly open myself to God in total receptivity, I'll be transformed into Him and would become a saint. So once again, you have an analogy between what happens in the mystery of the female body and what happens on us or in us through the mystery of divine grace. Women have a better sense of tradition than men. You know, up to the feminists, women were traditionalists because they knew that the past had a great deal to offer. Modern man has become so arrogant that he believes he knows everything better and can look down upon the past as being sort of morons and, you know, very undeveloped people. But now that we've gone to the moon, now that we can blow up the world, now that we have amazing computers, well, obviously we are superior. A woman knows, and particularly this is a religious category, the importance of tradition. And it's not by accidents that when Protestants broke away from the church, they limited themselves to the Bible and abandoned tradition. Thank you very much. They just reminded me in a very delicate way, you speak too much. So I'll simply say when I have to end, I simply say, please let us rediscover the beauty of femininity. And understand that if we have not, all of us who happen to be women, if we have not chosen to be women, and we might not have chosen it, that it is a grace and a blessing. Thank you.